From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. With the House of Representatives and the President once again butting heads over the federal budget, a government shutdown is looking more likely by the day. The only time the federal government has ever shut down due to budgeting issues was in 1995 when then-former House Speaker Newt Gingrich and former President Bill Clinton clashed on spending. This hour, Bob Bixby of the Concord Coalition joins us once again to talk about the complicated U.S. economy, the effect a shutdown could have on the country if Congress doesn't pass a new budget, and how the debt ceiling debate figures into the equation. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, here we go again, folks. Congress stands on the brink of another government shutdown as the two parties continue to fight over spending priorities. House Republicans are tying any increase in the debt ceiling to defunding the president's health care program, just as enrollment for that new program is set to begin next week. Meanwhile, a lot of experts say weak leadership on the Hill and in the White House is a recipe for a shutdown to actually go into effect. With us today to help us sort through what all of this means is Bob Bixby. He's executive director of the Concord Coalition. That's a nonpartisan organization that encourages fiscal responsibility in Washington and helps educate the public about the federal budget. And Bob, it's always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Well, it's great to be back with you, Steve.
Thanks, Bob. Well, you hear one word over and over again when it comes to this situation in Washington, and that is the word mess. You know, leadership is lacking. There's no game plan. Things appear to be careening, Bob. Am I missing anything here?
No, I think you've got it. Mess is a good word. Dysfunction is a good word.
I hear that a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really pretty depressing. I've been doing this for about 20 years, a little over 20 years.
And you're feeling a little down these days, let me see.
I am, yes. And yeah. I really haven't seen things quite this messy or dysfunctional ever. And this week seems to be the pinnacle.
Yeah. This week, a pinnacle because why?
Well, we've got the government set to shut down at the end of the week and apparently no negotiations going on how to prevent that from happening.
No negotiations at all between the White House and Congress, or just nothing?
There really isn't. You would assume, you hear the rhetoric and the dueling press conferences, and you would naturally assume that there must be something going on beneath the surface, that they must be talking and privately or something.
Well, you always assume that.
Apparently there isn't. There isn't any that I can discern. And so we're left with the feeling that there's no end game here. We just have, you know, folks going on parallel tracks impressing their base but not solving problems.
And it seems to me that maybe one scary component of all of this is that because we've been here before, because folks have been crying wolf in the past, you know, the public, I wonder how engaged are the average, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Citizen out there, given the fact that people are thinking, oh, they'll figure it out. We've been down this road before. They always figure it out at the end. So why call my member of Congress? Because they'll figure it out.
I think there is an element of that. People really get tired of there's sort of a crisis fatigue that sets in, and people assume that this is all some sort of a political kabuki dance, that they're just doing their thing and that, you know, at the last minute, surprise, a compromise will be found and things will go on. But and there's undoubtedly there's an element of that. But the problem is that folks are very dug in this time, and it could be that you could dance up to the edge and fall over by accident simply because you've boxed yourself into positions that you can't get out of.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of this that is alarming is that we're very, very, very focused on the very, very short term. So it's, you know, how do we get through next week or the week after that? And our federal budget problems are really much more long-term.
And lots of things to deal with way down the road, right? Yeah.
Right. It's, you know, even if we get through this temporary crisis, we have serious long-term budget problems.
Bob Bixby is our guest. He's executive director of the Concord Coalition. Again, that's a nonpartisan group that helps us sort out some of the fiscal issues in Washington. If you want to join our conversation here, 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Maybe you want to express your frustration about what you see going on with the right honorables out in D.C. these days. You can email us uptodate@kcur.org or just tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. So, Bob, with a lot of experts saying a shutdown is a likely outcome here, given the fact there's no negotiations going on right now, you were just saying, what's your sense of how likely a shutdown looks by week's end?
I think it's very likely. More so than it has been in the past. I think there are hard lines being taken here, and I don't really see that either side has given themselves an out. Without a lot, you know, and sort of insisting that the other side give in. And I don't think that that's a viable strategic negotiation position. So I think this is a pretty good chance that there's going to be a shutdown. I also think that the shutdown probably wouldn't last that long because that's when the public would begin to pay attention. I think that the complacency that you mentioned before, people assume that they'll get it all worked out. I think if the government actually were to shut down, people would say, oh, they didn't really get it all worked out. This is ridiculous. So I think that the shutdown might be kind of short-lived. But it doesn't alleviate the longer problems because we got the debt ceiling coming up in a couple of weeks, maybe a month or so, where it's different from the shutdown in the sense that right now we're facing a deadline where Congress is going to run out of spending authority through the annual appropriations bills. That's really what's happening.
I was going to say, let's back up here a little bit and explain some of these terms so everyone's sort of hanging with us out there. Right now, the nation is staring down, you know, the barrel of this government shutdown that will happen if Congress – that's because if it can't pass a budget, right? That's what that's tied to.
That's right.
Okay. And then you can you explain what that is and what does Congress need to do to prevent a shutdown? What has to happen?
Congress is supposed to every year pass 12 appropriations bills which fund the departments of government, including defense.
Right.
They have not passed any of those bills. Excuse me. So there is no funding authority beyond the end of the fiscal year, which happens to be September 30th. So those agencies would then have to shut down, aside from so-called essential personnel.
Because there's no money for them to spend.
Because there's no authority for the government to spend money on their activities.
Now, you said there's an exception, though, for what's regarded as essential government services. And exactly, Bob, what would that be?
Well, you would – yeah, I mean, soldiers would still be in the field. You'd still have border security. You'd still have, airline
– air traffic controllers.
Air traffic controllers and things like that. It's kind of an interesting time in the federal government where people find out if they're considered essential or not. You know, it's kind of like, am I furloughed because I'm not essential or what?
And who decides what's essential and what's not? Because I've read that the playbook on this front isn't real clear.
Right. There's a considerable leverage on the part of agency managers. They'll each determine who's eligible within their own departments based on certain guidelines.
Okay, so that's the government shutdown portion of all of this. And then you were beginning to talk about the debt ceiling, which is a separate issue, but obviously very much related here.
Right, that's a separate issue because what the shutdown issue has to do with spending authority and whether the government has passed its budget. The debt limit has to do with the government's ability, the Treasury Department's ability to issue debt, to borrow money in order to pay its bills, which is a very different thing. And they just happen to be converging at the same time. So what happens with the debt limit is that if you reach it, theoretically, the Treasury Department cannot borrow any money. Well, if you're in a deficit situation as we are, that means that the government could not pay its bills because it couldn't issue debt in order to get the cash to pay the bills. Like if you're running a business, a lot of businesses borrow constantly on a short-term basis in order to smooth out the cash flows. So the federal government does the same thing. It would still have money coming in from taxes, and so it could pay some bills. It just couldn't pay all of them.
So this notion of, you hear this phrase, government default, that would begin to go into effect if the debt ceiling is not raised, right? That's when the government's credit rating goes into play here.
Right. The government in that situation would not shut down. It just wouldn't be able to pay its bills. It would become a deadbeat. You know, some of its bills would be paid, some of its bills wouldn't. And nobody really knows how that would work, because it's never happened before. So Treasury isn't exactly sure if it has the authority to pay some bills and not pay other bills.
And Bob, to what extent is all of this a coincidence that both the debt ceiling and the budget issue are sort of coming at roughly the same time here?
Well, it's kind of coincidental, but kind of not, because the Congress raised the debt ceiling last time with an idea to sort of get through the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking that they would have passed a budget by the end of the year, which would have satisfied everybody enough to make them comfortable raising the debt limit.
Right.
Well, one didn't happen. We didn't do the budget. And so the debt limit is coming up with the problem not having been resolved. So in some ways it's an arbitrary, but in other ways it makes sense because they didn't do a budget, so they haven't been comfortable raising the debt limit.
I mean, just hearing you talk about this, just stepping back for a moment, I mean, this is just remarkable. I mean, here we are again. This is embarrassing. This is ridiculous. This is all of those words stacked up on top of each other, isn't it? I mean, am I missing something here?
No, I don't think so. It is.
I mean,
it is
a disgrace.
It is a disgrace. I mean, because we're talking, it's a basic failure of the political process. You know, it's really interesting when you look at the credit rating agencies that, you know, Standard & Poor's and Fitch's, Moody's, the ones that when they look at the federal government, what they express concern about is not our economic situation, it's our political situation. Because you're talking about the basic failure to resolve political disagreements. And, you know, some of them are very difficult issues. You know, people have very different views about the government's role and how much we should tax and what we should spend money on. But you work those things out. That's what the political process is for. And right now, we just have a political process that isn't flexible enough to solve basic problems.
And walk with me on that point just for a moment. It's not flexible, Bob, in what sense? I mean, I think everyone is basically familiar with this, but this notion that what these different sides are just so dug in and there's no willingness to have a give and take here, and that's led us to where we are right now.
Well, you can sort of look at a potential solution and work backwards. I mean, I think that take Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, a couple of former officials who were appointed to lead a commission 3 years ago, came up with a plan that got Democrats and Republicans together that would put some entitlement cuts on the table, Social Security and Medicare, would do some revenue increases. So right there, you've ticked off the Democratic base and the Republican base by saying it's going to take a mix of entitlement reforms and tax reform. So the dysfunction comes in that the majority of both parties have rejected that approach, with Republicans saying, we will not support any new taxes, no matter how they're derived, and Democrats saying we won't put the major and social insurance programs on the table, Medicare and Social Security. Now, if both would just concede that, okay, we're going to have to do a little bit of mix here and let's talk to each other, then we could begin to solve some problems. But you get people taking absolutist positions, saying, you know, I will not do X,
yeah, and that's what's leading to the problems here,
right? And ultimately, you do have to have a mix of options, because it's just, I think, substantively, it's important, but it's also just important politically.
So as we sit here today, then again, just to sort of step back and look at all this, it sounds to me, Bob, like you're saying that the government probably is going to shut down, and then we don't know exactly for sure what that's going to translate to in terms of what government services will be considered essential, which ones won't be. I assume we're going to begin to find that out this week leading up to the shutdown, or when will the citizenry figure out what's going to happen here if the government shuts down?
Well, the agencies have been told to prepare for a shutdown, so we'll get guidelines from them, clues from them during the week as they inform their employees whether or not they have to come to work next week.
So we'll find out who's essential and who's not. And again, who's deciding that exactly, who's showing up for work after a shutdown and who's not?
Well, the agency leaders, departments of government heads will have that, like a cabinet secretary or somebody. And obviously, the cabinet secretaries won't be probably sitting there themselves going through it.
But even that process is a little bit murky as to actually who decides what's essential and what's not.
Yeah.
That's our government today. That's
right.
American democracy at work.
And one of the reasons it's murky is people assume it isn't going to happen.
Yeah, right.
But it has happened in the past. And
how many times has it happened in the past?
Oh, I forget exactly how many times. But the last time was 95, 96.
That was the big one.
That was the big shutdown.
Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton were sort of squaring off. And
right.
What were the issues back then?
It was about the debt limit, and it was about the Medicare cuts, as I recall. The Republicans had a budget that wanted to cut Medicare, and Clinton did not want to do that. And eventually the debt limit got involved in that at the end as well. And that's really what brought it to the end. As I recall, I think it was Bob Dole, who was then still Senate Majority Leader, called a halt to it pretty much and said, this is ridiculous. They were able to reach some sort of an agreement.
Yeah.
Whether or not anybody is in a position to do that right now, I'm not sure.
Yeah. We'll talk about the potential political fallout from this in just a moment. If you want to join our conversation here, again, our guest, Bob Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition. If you want to join us and talk about how you feel about this potential government shutdown, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, UpToDate@KCUR.org. You can also tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Bob emails us this at UpToDate@KCUR.org. There will only be, fiscal balance when one side of a politician's mouth converges with the other side, and that will never happen, he says. Don't we need a constitutional amendment? Why won't they move in that direction?
A constitutional amendment
to
for
do what?
We
don't really know.
Impose rationality. He may mean a balanced budget amendment or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's something that that we could look at. I think I don't think we need a constitutional amendment, and I don't know that balancing the budget is something that you would necessarily want to put into the Constitution, because there might be ways to game it. And I'm not sure that it's you want to have a budget rule in the Constitution, but I think that I understand the frustration that maybe some sort of external forces that have to be applied. I would prefer to do it legislatively if they could come up with some sort of agreement and enforce it through budget rules that would automatically cut spending or raise taxes. If they didn't hit their targets, I think that
which
would
they
be...
Which they've sort of done with sequestration, right?
Yeah, they've sort of tiptoed in that area. In the 2 years ago, they enacted budget caps on the discretionary, the annual appropriations bills, and they automatically got tighter last year. That was the thing called sequestration, which basically means tighter caps. Even while sequestration is a sort of an irrational across-the-board cut, at least it's a policy. It's an automatic consequence, which they did let go into effect. And the problem with sequestration is not it's kind of a stupid way to cut spending across the board like that, but also it only affects about a third of the budget and not the third that is growing the most.
Which is Medicare and Medicaid.
Right. And so it basically leaves the entitlement programs off the hook because they don't go through the annual appropriations process. Some of them are subjected to the caps. But Medicare has a strict limit on how much it can be affected, and they haven't done anything about revenues. So, you know, I think you could look going in that direction, but it'd have to have a better process than the one that they have in effect right now.
Okay, so we've mentioned that we have this sequestration process in effect, these automatic cuts that have taken place. That raises a question in my mind. So is the federal budget deficit growing right now or dropping, given the fact we have sequestration? And what's happening with the national debt, which is, I guess, related, but again, slightly different things?
The bottom line is the deficit is coming down. The debt is going up.
How can that be?
Well, because we still have
a
deficit.
Is explain the difference there.
Right. The deficit is the annual shortfall.
In the budget.
Mm-hmm.
We're spending more than we're taking in.
Exactly.
Right.
And for the last 4 years, we've had deficits over $1 trillion, which is off the charts. I mean, that's just in our history, that's just astronomically high. Had a lot to do with the recession and attempts to deal with it. So now the recession has been over where we have a very slow recovery, but we do have a recovery. And so revenues are beginning to come back up. There was, you know, some increase in taxes at the end of last year. Spending is coming down. And so the budget deficit this year is going to be around $600 to $650 billion, which is still a lot.
So it's down quite a bit from the trillion-dollar level.
Yeah, it was over a trillion last year. So it's coming down. A lot of that is the natural forces of the economy getting better. There's some legislative change like the sequestration and the tax increases, but it's still leaving us with a budget deficit of about $600 billion, which is pretty big.
And that adds to the federal
right. And so each annual deficit adds to the total national debt.
Right.
So that's why you can have a deficit coming down even considerably, but the debt is still going up. And so the key equation in all of this is the debt rising faster than the economy? And if the debt is rising faster than the economy, it means that the government is falling behind in its ability to pay its bills.
So what is happening?
Yeah, if you want to think of it, which is what is happening. So if you want to think of it in terms of a family budget is you know, you can take on debt so long as you're okay servicing that debt because you have enough income to do it, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
If Bill Gates wants to take out a $2 million mortgage, no problem. If I were to try to do that, it would be foolish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you have to sort of measure the debt by the size of the economy. So that's why a lot of economists talk about not a specific dollar figure, but how much is the debt relative to the size of the economy. So, you know, what we should be trying to do is make sure the debt isn't growing faster than the economy.
That's the voice of Bob Bixby. You explain this stuff so well, Bob. He's executive director of the Concord Coalition. That's a nonpartisan group that encourages fiscal responsibility in Washington and helps educate the public, which he's doing right now, about the federal budget. 816-235-2888. Lots of calls for Bob Bixby. Let's go to some of them now. Jennifer from Merriam. Jennifer, good morning.
Yes, good morning. My question is, you know, we've got this checks and balances system set up for a government. Where's the third leg? You know, what's going on? These people are in D.C. They're being paid to make the budget each month. They're being paid to do the stuff that they're not doing. I mean, they're essentially running off with our money, and they're not being held accountable. What's going on?
So who can hold them accountable, Jennifer, is what you're asking about, right?
Well, like, where's the Supreme Court?
Where's the Supreme Court, Bob Bixby? Where's that?
Where's the judicial part?
Yeah. Yeah. Where's the Supreme Court right now, Bob?
Well, the Supreme Court doesn't have much to say about this because, you know, you'd have to bring a case or something. I mean, they don't just go around, you know, looking for things to do. You have to have a case that comes up to the Supreme Court. You know, how to hold there's only one way to hold Congress accountable, and that's through the elections. That's the people.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't like what members of Congress are doing, that's, you know, you write to them, you go to their town hall meetings, you don't vote for them.
Yeah. That's the way to keep them accountable, Jennifer.
I was hoping, you know, the third branch would at least, you know, help pick a side or something and get things moving along.
Well,
thank you for.
Well, they don't get involved in so-called political decisions, and like I say, there'd have to be some sort of a case brought to maybe to sue a member of Congress for dereliction of duty. I don't know. That might be an interesting test case.
Jennifer, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Let's go to Alex from Lenexa. Alex, good morning.
Good morning. A couple questions. I'm just trying to educate myself here for the average Joe, like most of us that work 9-to-5 jobs.
Right.
It's just kind of hard to keep up with all the lingo, quantitative easing, sequestering.
I understand that, Alex.
What is quantitative easing? Who is the Fed giving money to? Is it the Treasury or different banks? And my other question is, how much more are they trying to raise this debt limit by? And I would also like to see more educational programs, like the program the gentleman runs there. Maybe some type of public television or right. I don't know if it should be state-run, something to educate people. Because truth of the matter is, a lot of us out here, we're too busy. We got families, we got households
yes.
to run. We can't keep up with all of that. Everything seems layered. And all these changes, just like the caller before me, she said, where's the checks and balances at? Where's the accountability at? And everything just seems layered. And as much as the media talks about this federal budget and deficit, it should be more programs out there to explain
right.
that to people. So when they're voting for different individuals or institutions, we'll know what we're voting for.
Alex, I feel your pain. Bob, let's talk about some of his questions here, a little bit about what the Fed is doing these days and this notion of quantitative easing.
It's an interesting way of saying printing money.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, what the Federal Reserve controls the money supply in the United States, and it's what they tried to do when the economy went really, really bad to avoid another great recession was to pump money, print money into the economy, to make up for the fact that consumers were taking money out. I mean, mm-hmm. they weren't spending. The government was laying people off. Businesses were laying people off. And there was concern about some sort of a death spiral for the economy that to increase supply of demand,
mm-hmm.
that the Fed would step in and do that. So that's what quantitative easing is. It's basically putting money into the system. Now, you can do that for a while, and we've done it very aggressively for several years now. But eventually, if you do that for too long, you would get inflation problems. But we haven't seen that just yet. So the biggest problem for the Fed right now is when to cut back on this artificial stimulus of the economy.
And they just announced last week that they weren't going to cut back, at least for the foreseeable future, right? That was what drove the stock market up real big one day last week. Yeah.
It's a little bit like getting addicted to this easy money that you get addicted mm-hmm. to. It may be necessary and a good thing to have avoided a depression in the short term. But you can imagine this like a lot of drugs. They're fine when you're sick. And then mm-hmm. the painkiller still feels pretty good and I'm not sick anymore. And that's when you have a problem. And so breaking this easy money phenomenon is going to be tough, because you saw earlier this year when the Fed even hinted that it was going to pull back on some of this easy money and that the markets, went kind of nuts
right.
for a little while because they kind of like the easy money. But we're going to have to break this eventually. The Fed knows that it's going to have to cut back on that easy money.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get more phone calls and talk to Bob Bixby about the political fallout of what all this could mean. Bill, Dave, Ted, hang on. I'll get to your calls here in just a moment. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about environmental policy with activist Robert Kennedy Jr. and Bill McKibben, you can find that in all of our previous broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. This hour, we're visiting with Bob Bixby of the Concord Coalition. That's a nonpartisan group that helps explain what in the heck is going on in Washington with all this fiscal madness these days. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, update@kcur.org. A listener from Overland Park writes us this, Bob. Earlier in the program, Steve used the notion of equivalence to describe this problem, i.e. both sides are so entrenched. With all due respect, that's not the case, this listener writes. This is not a pox on both houses. This is a Republican problem. And until we really talk about that, it allows this game to go on as if no one is to blame. That simply isn't true. There is something deeply disturbing about the values and tactics of a small portion of the Republican Party that needs to be discussed in the open. What about that, Bob? Is there a sense of that there's some truth to that or not?
Well, I do think that if you get down to it, both parties are pretty dug in. What is highlighting the problem right now is a faction in the Republican Party which is carrying things more to a limit than has been in the past.
Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, and others like
right,
like Ted.
Yeah. And in the House, there's a group of 40 to 60 or so that have made life hell for John Boehner, the Speaker, who I think is inclined to want to cut deals. But mm-hmm. I don't say that in a bad way. And the idea of cutting deals being a bad thing tells us a little bit about the dysfunction, because of course you have to cut mm-hmm. deals. It means compromising with the other side. It's not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you certainly have some people that will not budge and that are willing to shut down the government or default on the debt if they don't get their way. And that's obviously an obstructionist tactic.
Now, one deal that's out there is this notion of what the House passed this last week, which is legislation that says we'll fund the budget, but part of that has to be a defunding of the president's health care program. Again, am I seeing that correctly?
Yes, that is.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's worth it. And now it's up to the Senate to decide whether it will go along with that. The Senate's run by Democrats, so they will almost certainly not defund Obamacare, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit of this, I mentioned political kabuki dance. I mean, what's going on
I love
here
that phrase.
Is the House was insistent, the House Republican caucus was insistent that this condition of defunding Obamacare be attached to the bills that would fund the rest of the government. And so, you know, the House put that on the bill and sent it over to the Senate, which knowing that the Senate would reject it and send it back to the House. And so what's going to happen later this week, I don't really know. But I think that's where I think the shutdown will probably come in, because the House will not just accept what the Senate did. They will want to do something and send it back to the Senate.
Yeah.
And so I think for a few days we'll go through this, and we may have a shutdown for a week or something like that. We might avoid a shutdown by having a temporary funding bill that only lasts for a week or something. That could be an alternative.
Don writes us this at update@kcur.org. Bob, it seems strikingly artificial to not elaborate on the motivation of the House Republicans' desire to defund the Affordable Care Act. This is not merely a story of intransigent Democrats versus intransigent Republicans on their relative budget concerns. This is not a story of one evil against another evil. This is a story about an artificially created crisis by a significant group of Republicans going outside the legislative process to force their way on a policy question when they could not get their way with either the legislative or electoral processes.
Well, again, I mean, this gets back to, you know, who's to blame. And I think that the immediate issue here, let me say that if you want to defund or repeal Obamacare, that's a perfectly legitimate legislative goal. And the House is, that's the will of the House. That's what they want to do. So it's not surprising that they – and it's not improper to send over a bill with that condition. What I think is the Senate isn't going to accept it. So at that point, you have to decide, is it worth shutting down the entire government? My my judgment on that would be no. I think that it's irresponsible to do that, because shutting down the government would not defund or repeal Obamacare. Defunding the entire government would not defund Obamacare, because most of it operates on autopilot as an entitlement program.
Yeah.
So it is not a logical way to achieve your objective. So I'm with the Republicans in the Senate, like John McCain and Lindsey Graham, Kelly Ayotte, and others who say this is a stupid way to go.
Mm-hmm.
We should, if we want to defund Obamacare, you know, bring up a bill to do that, but don't shut down the rest of the government to do it. So I agree with the caller. I think when you look at the broad, you know, why don't we have a grand bargain type of thing, looking beyond this week, I think there's more of a symmetry there of the two parties not wanting to compromise.
You've said, speaking of grand bargains, which is this idea that the president and Speaker Boehner discussed a year or two ago and actually seemed to come to some agreement on. This is a grand bargain. It's really looking at the entire federal budget and making any number of changes to really radically begin to cut government spending and deal with so many of these issues in one fell swoop, right?
Right. That was the concept of the grand bargain, is something like Bull Simpson that would say, okay, we're going to have to look at the entitlement programs, we're going to have to look at taxes, and we have to make compromises between the two, so let's look at all of it at once.
And you think there's still room for doing just that? You've written as much, Bob.
I think it's the only way out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're looking at trench warfare and what it's getting us. And what it's getting us is incremental crisis to crisis.
Right.
This is just crazy what we're doing now. And the only way we're going to end this cycle is to have some sort of grand bargain between the two parties.
Okay. Let's go back to some phone calls. We have some good calls waiting. Dave from Kansas City, Missouri. Dave, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Bixby, with all due respect, you include entitlements, i.e. Social Security, and we won't talk about Medicare, as part of the debt and deficit and where we need to cut. And surely you know that Social Security is not part of the debt.
What about that, Bob? Explain that to us.
Well, I don't know that, because it is part of the debt. And here's the thing. Social Security is it's about 20% of the budget. It's it pays out more than it takes in. Now that's a fairly recent phenomenon. The dedicated payroll tax in the past has always covered benefits, but we're in a situation now where Social Security is paying out more than it takes in, and so yes, it does add to the deficit, because what happens is the government needs to sell bonds, borrow money in order to.
It does not, because it has a $2.7 trillion surplus right now.
No, but that's on paper. And that's on paper.
No, those are government bonds, and the 14th Amendment says the United States government will meet its debts. We wouldn't default on our bonds to China or any other country. Why would we default on our bonds for Social Security?
We would not, and I'm not saying that we would. We would make good on those bonds, but they are government bonds, and so they have to be satisfied by the Treasury, which has to come up with the cash to make good on those bonds. And that means that the Treasury would have to issue other debt to the public to raise the cash to make good on the obligation to pay the Social Security money. So what you're talking about is the trust fund accounting, which is accurate. But from a budgetary perspective, it's the Social Security system is contributing to the deficit.
Mr. Bixby, you know the Omnibus Budget Act in 1995, that the Social Security is off budget. It is off budget. It has a surplus. It cannot run a deficit. It has to be funded by payroll tax fully, not by general revenue.
Okay,
general revenue that goes into it.
Yes, there is. I'll try it again. But the bonds that the Social Security has in the trust fund can only be satisfied by the Treasury Department selling bonds to the public to raise the cash. That cash is general revenues. I mean, it's Social Security does have a general revenue subsidy right now. It's very small. It's not as small as Medicare, but it will get bigger as the boomers begin to retire and as we make good on those trust fund obligations. So, you know, you can, you know, have an accounting system for Social Security that's separate, but you can't remove it from the economy or from the budget altogether. And this is all actually explained in an appendix in the Social Security Trustees Report. If you want to go online and read it, there's a very good section explaining the difference between trust fund accounting and budgetary accounting. And I would urge readers to do that. SSA.gov and look for the Trustees Report and the appendix on just this issue.
Dave, I appreciate the phone call. Let's move on here. Let's go to Bill from North Kansas City. Bill, good morning. You're on with Bob Bixby. Good morning from the Concord Coalition.
Good morning. It is an excellent, excellent show.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Bixby is doing a very good job
of
trying to stay people. My only issue is with those who like to see the constraint of spending starting to take the household analogy, which shows that they think that they can simplify things by, if you don't have enough money coming into your household, you won't be able to spend anymore. And yet, in my household, I would not buy a house from David Glass, the owner of the Royals, that I can't afford, and then loan him money at an interest rate so he can pay me back. And what we do in the tax system, when we give credits to defense contractors where they buy submarines, which, by the way, I don't operate a nuclear submarine in my household either. So I think that by using those analogies, I think you're trying to bias people to think that this is a very simple plus and minus system. And so I just take more issue to the terminology that you use, because I believe that that way you can sway those who are not as inclined to inform themselves about the complexity of our government.
Bob?
Well, that's a legitimate point. And, you know, there's always a tension between trying to provide analogies that help people think about things or, you know, oversimplifying a situation. Mm-hmm. So the federal government and the federal budget is clearly a lot more complicated than the household budget. So I take your point. But I also think it's sometimes helpful for people to relate overall issues to something that they have a little bit of experience with, because nobody has experience with managing a $3 trillion budget and all of the various trust funds and machinations that go on, such as the things that you described. So that's, you know, the point is not to try to oversimplify, but to try to, you know, give people some sort of framework for analysis.
But is it not fairer to allow people to realize that this is an immensely complex system where there are political favors that are truly financial gains for major people with big money, and then we write them off and call them a tax credit? I'm not even talking about deductions for expenses. These are just pure credits. This is just giving them a check. And these things are hidden, such as when Mr. Yoder was on last year with Mr. Cleaver, and they said, yes, we need to reform the tax system. And yet here we are arguing about Social Security and Obamacare when we should be dealing with the tax system.
Well, I think that we should be dealing with both, because I think it's going to take both. One of the issues that's being debated now in Washington, I think, on tax reform is whether or not we need to get rid of most of those credits, deductions, exemptions, exclusions, things that drain revenue from the system, that are exceptions to the current system. And we could indeed raise revenue without raising rates. You could even lower rates if you got rid of some of those things. Now, some of the here's the caveat. Some of those credits that you're talking about, we should get rid of, but it wouldn't save anywhere near the sum of money. We may be talking about a few billion dollars, $10 billion. I don't know. I'm just sort of making a guess here. Whereas if, you know, you're trying to look at saving $2 trillion or so over the next 10 years in order to just to stabilize the growth of the debt. So that's why I think you need to put everything on the table.
We're talking about the federal budget. We're talking about the possibility of a government shutdown in a week or so. Bob Bixby is our guest. He's executive director of the Concord Coalition, a nonpartisan group that encourages fiscal responsibility in D.C. and helps educate us about all the goings-on out there. Bob, I just want to touch base for a moment on politics about all of this. I mean, the last time this happened in the mid-90s, we talked about it a little bit earlier. This happened right in the wake of the Monica Lewinsky scandal that obviously enveloped President Clinton. And even though that controversy had waged so brightly for so long, the Democrats, not the Republicans, Democrats ended up winning seats in the 98 midterm elections, didn't retake a majority in the House, but won back four or five seats. And I'm just wondering, the public seemed to blame the Republicans at that time for the shutdown. There seems to be some indication that could happen again this time. Why is that the case? And if it's the case, why are Republicans pressing this so hard if they may pay a price politically for it?
Well, I think that they may have forgotten the lesson of the 90s because it really did seem to the public, even though the Republicans had come in on a wave of victories in the 94 congressional elections.
Right.
And they were pushing a budget that President Clinton had some objections to, most of them over Medicare, I think. And so Speaker Gingrich, Newt Gingrich, pushed his advantage. And so it seemed to the public when the government was shutting down that it was over a Republican initiative, and they thought that President Clinton had some legitimate objections. And so I think that there was just a perception there that if there was a shutdown, it was over a Republican initiative. I think they're threatening they're risking the same perception now with the push to defund or repeal Obamacare, valuing it over everything else, even if the public has some questions about Obamacare or even opposition to it. The idea that it's okay to shut down all of government or default on the debt unless this particular law is repealed is inevitably going to be viewed by the public as an unrealistic demand, holding hostage, the rest of the government for one initiative.
And do you think that's likely how it'll play out this time, that they'll be seen as sort of the fall guys for this shutdown if indeed that happens?
Yes. I think, okay. I mean, there's very little question about that.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Ted from Tonganoxie. Ted, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for holding on, Ted.
Hi. Appreciate it. First of all, hello to the NSA. Our paranoia has reached unbelievable dimensions. We have 700 military bases around the world. Do you think that's being paranoid? I think so. I think the Republican voters in Kansas who keep reelecting, I used to be a Republican at one time, but they've gone out over the deep end now. And they need to get off this Affordable Care Act. At least we got something through, and it looks like it could be workable, right? Okay, we need to stop voting these Republicans in. although I do think that the two-party system is basically broken, and there needs to be something else done there.
Ted, give me a question for Bob Bixby, if you would.
A question. I was mostly just getting off some steam.
Yeah, that's fine, but, Ted. I appreciate that. I'm going to move on to some folks who do have questions here. Okay,
go ahead.
Thank you, Ted. JJ from Overland Park. JJ, good morning. You're on with Bob Bixby. Good morning. You there, JJ? Susan from Kansas City North. Susan, good morning.
Hi. This is what I'd suggest to the gentleman from the Commonwealth. Instead of using the analogy of a household, use the analogy of a business. A business has receivables, and they also have products. Sometimes it may take up to 120 days or longer to get the money back that from the people that you have sold products to. And that's more like our government. than our households. And that's all I have to say.
All right, Susan. Thank you. Bob, just maybe one key argument from Republicans in the House particularly is that Obamacare is harming the economy and will continue to do so. Is that true?
Well, you know, there's so many different arguments about that. I don't know you can say whether it's true or not. I think in the job statistics, it doesn't appear to be true. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that businesses are not hiring as much and reclassifying workers. So this, I don't know you could just draw a line and and say yes or no on that. People are going to have different perspectives.
So what's going to happen this week? Any sense of what the schedule ahead is trying to work this out? Are there any meetings planned that you're aware of in the days ahead?
I don't know of any meetings that are planned in the days ahead. I think what you can probably expect is that the Senate will take out the Obamacare provision and send the appropriations bill back to the House. My guess is that they'll do it later in the week and in an effort to so-called jam the House and leave them very little time. And I suspect that the House is anticipating that and probably has something that they plan to add back onto the bill and bounce it back to the Senate as soon as they can towards the end of the week. So it's like, you remember that old kids game, Time Bomb, where you sort of throw the ball, the thing and forth and see who it ends up blowing up? I think we're going to see a little game of Time Bomb going on between the House and Senate at the end of the week.
Well, Bob, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for taking some time to explain all this to us, and you've just been great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Again, Bob Bixby is Executive Director of the Concord Coalition. You can find more information about all of our broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. For KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.
This is KCUR FM, KCUR HD1, Kansas City Public Media. Good morning, I'm Kim Noble. Here and Now is next. It's followed by The World, and we're going to be taking a look at the latest from Nairobi on both shows, actually.